Sorry, we're a little bit late, but we've got late commissioning for lunch, so we crimp some of your time. Not specifically yours, but yes, it does work.
Very small. Commissioners, I'm just here to talk to the submission by Maori Tourism. In particular, two points of submission that relate to the space for water-based activities in the Dark River. And so there's submitter number 716. And they appear in your report at paragraph 17.55 and 17.56. Is that anything? You're familiar with those? So if I can, and really that's in the officer's report, those paragraphs. And the officer is advised in his report that he thinks additional information should be provided to assist with the Commission's understanding of the nature of the decision. So, I was just going to briefly take these through. If I could ask a question, first of all, though, if the Commission is familiar with the Dark Sea activity, or if you would like to put run through what happens.
I've read all the facilities about them. Other commissioners may not be certain.
No. Probably looking worthwhile. Could we just a quick run through? There's a convoluted history about the conditions of its consents and activities up there. The general nature is that people are taken by bus to the Norby, they are dropped off at the marina, and from there they hop on a jet boat, which taken parts of the Dark River through the greater section of the Dark River. They will usually pop into the Rockburn, which is a tributary on the true right bank of the river. And then the trip continues past China's Bluff, all the way up to very close to near known as Sandy Bluff, which is pretty much where the National Park starts. And at that point, both sides of the jet boats turn around and back to Manuki, or if they are carrying inflatable kites or funyaks, then they'll drop them off at the confluence of the slipstream, a small tributary, and there they'll inflate the kite, the funyaks, and those people will pop the funyaks and float down the river and get most of the way back to just the China's Bluff, I think it is. Otherwise, I've got some maps here,
because it's a long trip, actually, 3 days coming together.
Otherwise, if you're in the jet boat, you travel from the slipstream, so they're actually
So the trip commences at Manuki and travels up as far as Sandy Bluff. The funny thing is hopping in there. And then they will travel all the way down to about China's, which is about here. The road. Then the jet boats will travel all the way back to Manuki. And various, I was going to talk to you about, but Mark, the dark track. It's just a track that winds all the way around the kitchen for them. That is Beansburn, a tributary that we're going to talk to you about. That's the Rockburn. And this is the Rockburn that comes in. So that's the general track that we're going to do. And
as you can see, it's a graded river for a pretty long section of the trip. And there were originally three jetboat operators on the river. They were Wilderness Jet. There was Founder Safaris, and there was Kemp. And between the three of them, they set a lot of New Zealand visitors coastal. And in addition, there was also Eric Hughes, Funyaks. What has happened subsequent to all that is that Motuhake Tourism has acquired all of those companies and now runs all three jetboat companies under one banner and also operates the Funyak operation as well. And they've diversified a little bit with some bushwalks and four-wheel drive tools and stuff like that. So that's the kind of summary of the scene. The other interesting thing is the resource management issues that are alive up here. And over the course of a series of environment hearings, staying through to safety, in between jetboat companies in those days, because they were all conflicted with one another, jetboats with other private jetboat operators who, opening there are no restrictions, and then jetboats and funyaks, which is a terrible mix, because the jetboats travel about 75k and are often not seen because of the steep banks and the turns and variations in the river. There was also the amenity of the people on the down track, highlighted that was a section 6 issue, which is two and more emergency basin rivers. And thirdly, it was an area of spiritual significance in Otago. It is one of the more significant areas for Otago. So that was a great combination of issues. So what we ended up with was two issues that Motuhake Tourism has submitted on. Line of thought. The district plan now reflects a lot of those environmental decisions. And there are numerous decisions, and I've got a couple of references that helps. Two in particular, C151-2000, which was the addition. I could give you a full list of all decisions if you wish, but that was one, and that was one that added additional jetboat trips to the river, resulting in 26 trips in total, which is what we now have. So that was probably the most significant decision. Of interest is another decision called Title A130-2003, which was a refusal by the court of 15 funyak trips by one of those operators who tried to add more activity on the river. And that was a bit of a court saying, well, these are the values of the river. You're going past the threshold of what's appropriate on this stretch of river. So that was another interesting decision. So the district plan, the proposed plan anyway, represents those decisions in that it caps the number of commercial jetboat trips to 26, which was the combination of three earlier jetboat operators. And what it also does separately is it prohibits access into the tributaries of the Dart River, with the exception of the Rockton. And the solution of Motuhake Tourism is that they also operate briefly in Beansman, which is another tributary which I highlight on those maps. And they've been doing that for many, many years. So really there's two aspects that I wanted to briefly talk to you about. The first was that there is, in relation to the quantum of trips up the river, the cap of 26 is limited to two commercial operators under the current rule. That's the proposed rule, sorry, and the current rule. And really, purely out of administrative efficiency, there is only one commercial operator up the river. And so if you've got planner's report, paragraph 1755, the relief that was sought was that the relief that was sought was to just simply strike out no more than two commissioners of growth operators and replace with one commissioner of growth operator. The alternative relief would be simply to delete the last sentence of that rule. Okay. I'm not sure if commissioners are following well. You've got the rule in front of you?
Yes, I've got the rule in front of me. That's 21.547.3 and 4.
That's right. So it's simply the reference to one commercial jet boat operator. And Naitahu Tourism said that that could be misleading and confusing both the district council and for other people reading the plan. Where the current refers to two commercial jet boat operators, there is only one. It might make more sense for there to be no reference to any numbers of operators and simply rely on the fact that the total number of jet boat trips should not exceed 26 per day, which is the current consent environment.
Just saying there were no more than two, so that obviously applies for one, if that was the objective.
Yes, no more than two. It is based on, because that rule was carried over from the operative district plan, and that rule was written at the time when they were two. And so that it was referring to Kent and Douglas Sparks.
But is Naitahu concerned that another operator might use the wording of that rule to attempt to get trips on the dark?
Well, that's part of it. It is confusing, and it does signal on the one hand that there's a cap of 26 trips a day, and on the other hand that two commercial operators are okay. And really, this is the opportunity to say, well, the ownership structure on the river has changed and there is only one operator. So that's the first matter. So I want to address one, which is actually in reverse order. The other is the proceedings, paragraph 17.55 of the Officer's Report, which refers to a rule about a restriction on where commercial recreation and commercial boating activities can occur. And that is, it's in Table 9 in the rules, 21.5.44.
What page is that?
21.5.44. And it's, that should be 21.5.44.3. And from your reference, that rule states that it refers to the use of motorised craft on lakes and rivers being prohibited. And in this case, it refers to any tributary of the Dart and the Rees River except the Rotorua tributary of the Dart River. And simply, again, for administrative certainty, Naitahu Tourism wants to identify that they have, for many, many years, and previous operators too, have operated for just a sort of 200 metres of up Beansburn, where they actually beach their boats, and customers can step out of the boats and go to the toilets, which is in the bush. It's a dock-approved toilet facility, and can come back and pop in the boats and continue down the road.
And you can see to reflect that for them?
They have concession for that, but it's generally part of their trip. I've been looking back to see if these
are the consents from the 90s. The consents for the boat history?
Yes, that's what I've been checking is the consents from the 90s. Yes, the applications are a bit more brief than they would be today.
Decisions are probably even briefer.
Decisions are really brief. for my neighbours we left. However, given that it's prohibited status that's proposed in the rules, my target tourism simply wanted to have the same reference like the Lockburn is excluded, purely so that in the future monitoring enforcement got the result, they're aware that that part of the trip is always considered. And you can see that on those topo plans. It's a logical halfway point in the trip, and quite often customers do toilet breaks. So it's useful.
Why is the Rockburn identified in the plan here, but Bingsburn is not?
Good question. Certainly the Rockburn is, it's a little bit different to the Bingsburn. Bingsburn would just appear, I think, it's an ordinary tributary. The Rockburn is something quite special. It's almost a cathedral effect when you can navigate up a very narrow tributary into a large rock pool.
Mm.
And it's always been quite a feature of the journey.
So that's the area that you've got circled as
it's just that feature.
Correct.
And it's quite a long way up. Probably 400 or 500 metres, I imagine. And it's quite precarious.
Yeah.
It only certain times of the year you can access the rock.
Probably 12 and a half. According to
the. I've been trying to record the trip. But, and you get to a quite enclosed sheltered area that you sit in the boats, and it's quite a narrow turnaround area. I think that's been identified because that was always seen as being a little bit of a step away from the main stem of the Dark River. And Doc had always been interested in the GPOs moving into this type of territory. While in the case of the Beansburn, it simply is it's quite a different experience. It's more splitting up a side stream. It's not as unique as it might be if you move to Rockville. And that's all I can advise is the possible reason I was being sick.
Thank you. In relation to the threshold that we discussed, 21.5.47.4, presumably, because there is reference to both 26 trips in any one day and also no more than two commercial jet boat operators, does Naitapu Tourism own those 26 trips?
Yes, it does.
So there is no practical way that another operator, other than if they apply separately for additional trucks, could operate on that river? Is that
yes, or if they decide to sell some trucks.
Okay. And so, presumably, the reference to two commercial jetboat operators limits the amount of conversations that would need to be had about timing and sort of thing. So
that was, yes, at the time there was a lot to do with communication between operators. Because they move in and out of signal, sometimes certainly the old repeaters, rather than the river.
Yep.
So in terms of their communication on the river, there was concerns about how many operators could be there and whether they would operate or cooperate with one another.
But if nothing else changed at the moment, and the wording stayed in that role as it is, then there's no chance that another commercial operator.
They would have to obviously apply to bridge the rule of the 26 trips.
Okay. Thank
you.
was it the Morningstar Beach? Wasn't that going to be on a two?
No.
Morningstar, you know, the Nathas Points?
No.
Yeah. Which was John Evans as well, because it's shot over the jet.
No, that might be...
Okay.
Off somewhere else or something else.
Okay. Yeah.
Excuse me, Mr. Major. It's information that Mr. Edmonds table, is that going to be uploaded? I can get a look at it, and I might need to have a look at it.
We'll wait for the update after the film.
That's fine.
Everything's freezing, we might have to put the scan in the room.
Is that the change? I think we
can. Or you can reduce them and scan them.
Good afternoon, how are you? I am reading on behalf of my sister Susan and Carol, who can't be here this afternoon, and then Jim is reading on behalf of herself. I'm going to go first because mine is very short.
Okay.
Jim is going to go second.
Are there copies for us? Or?
Yes, there are. Okay, so I'm Philip Bunn and I'm reading...
Can you just wait a minute?
Yep, please.
This will be better than that.
Okay, I'm reading on behalf of Susan Cleaver and Carol Bunn. We're part of a farming family that has had land at Morgan Creek Road and Morgan Hill. We also own a house in Arrowtown. I and my brothers and sisters grew up and went to school in both Arrowtown and Queenstown. Our family are fifth generation descendants of J.W. Robson in the first year of Queenstown. We have seen the district grow and expand as our parents, grandparents and so on. Right back to the 1860s, we support the district's growth, but we would like to see the QLDC extend their planning and thinking of that growth out to 50 years instead of 10 years. Specifically, we want to highlight the following areas. Historic and heritage buildings that are currently on rural general lands be able to be considered for subdivision development so that they can be maintained and preserved for future generations. We support the encouragement of commercial and non-commercial residential activities, especially in rural locations that are next to or near the New Zealand, so Queenstown and New Zealand cycle trails. That the ONL and ONS lines are adjusted. Currently, they include areas of land that are not ONL beaches, such as farming areas that have been ploughed and modified for 50 plus years. They also run through residential and medium density zones. And then we support the evidence of Jimmy McColl. Do you want me to read this?
No, I will take those as written.
Take those as written, yeah.
Any of the other pieces? That is quite something.
The other two down the bottom are both quotes of Paddy Baxter and Dean Farrell.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any questions for this question?
No, no questions for me. Questions?
How many other working farms are there in the
Wanganui
area?
There's ours. Alan Hamilton still has his farm there, which he runs it here on. He runs it at a very low rate. He's 87 years old and running it. And so he just basically has some deer on it to keep it maintained. Yeah. And then there's more Morgan Ferry Limited between us and them. They have grazed out sometimes, when they're not grazed out, sometimes they just grazed out. We're really the only two. Hamilton's and us are two farms in that area that have been there for a long time.
thank you.
Ms. McCall.
Good afternoon. My name is Susan McCall, and I'm speaking on behalf of the South Hunter Alley. We own 90 hectares of land on Norman Hill, which overlooks Great Haven and the Kaikawa River. Also speaking on behalf of my family, you know, Barnacle Limited, which has land on the Kaikawa Road. The number of traditional arable and livestock farms in the Rocket Basin has been declining since the 1980s. Livestock farming especially is becoming more difficult because of the ever-increasing population and demand for rural land for residential purposes. My personal experience of these difficulties and how I have had to adapt to my farming style to continue farming over the last 30 years as follows. My late husband and I purchased our vacated property in 1985. It was at that point considered a stepping stone farm by the Rural Bank. And as such, we were able to get a Rural Bank loan to purchase it with a 20% deposit, 30 goats and 12 red deer as collateral. We stocked the farm with 300 very fine merino weathers, which we grazed not only on our Hillbrook farm, but also on the Lake Hay Showground and the reserves towards Bentley Bay. We often shifted these 300 weathers along State Highway 6 from Alec Robbins Road to the Showground Gate, with little or no traffic encountered on a short journey along the road. About 20 years ago, it became a very daring adventure to shift sheep along the State Highway. Also about the same period of time, sheep farming became a possibility for me when my neighbour sold his bull sheds to become an art gallery. Luckily, deer farming was more stable, so I changed to deer and beef livestock. Today, as previously mentioned, we run two properties in conjunction with transporting hinds to Lake Hayes in the spring and hinds performed back to Mr. Berry in the autumn. During this process, we have to wait up to 5 minutes to turn on State Highway 6. The change in 30 years has been significant, and in the next 30 years will even be greater. I predict in 30 years' time, State Highway 6 will be at least 4 lanes, and I will have to wait at traffic lights to turn either direction from Alec Robbins Road. My located property is quite unique in that it is situated on both sides of Northern Hill. Linked through the saddle, one side looks out onto Lake Hayes, a very busy state highway, $1 million plus homes, 2 wineries, views to Arrowtown, Cronachie, Speedfield, Benline, and beyond. The other side of my farm looks out over the Kaikawa River to the east and is completely the opposite. No houses, but an eastern Kaikawa River view with jet boats and cycle trails. The saddle area contains some perfect areas for self-contained off-the-grid tourism. Glamping, or very fancy camping, is a worldwide road market. To date, there are very few opportunities for glamping in the Wapitipi Basin. Both Lake Hayes and Northern Ferry Road property lend themselves 100% to this type of market. But here is my problem. All the rural general area of my Lake Hayes farm is in Awanau. Does it all need to be? In my view, no. The rural rules need to be enabling to allow for future growth, be it farming related industries, tourist accommodation or some new tourism venture. The back of Morton Hill could easily be the next new downhill biking and hiking park similar to Bob's Peak. One of the representatives of the Queenstown Trails Trust sent to us at a meeting after we had finalised the location of the trail, through the Barnum Corporate Barnum Trust property. It's time for you as a family to roll the dice. She meant, don't think of the trail as a major infringement of the on their farm, but think of it as an exciting new opportunity. In particular, these 4 policies, 21.2.9.7, 21.2.10.1, and 0.2 and 0.3, may give us the chance to do just that. These policies are an excellent improvement in enabling activities other than agriculture to occur in the rural areas. The next part of my submission is all the policy changes that I would like to see.
Would you be happy if we top those as well?
Yes, absolutely. Can I talk to a couple of them?
Yes, certainly.
The first that I'd like to talk to is farm buildings. And it's in 21.2.1.2. And we've asked an editor to provide a farm building for it with a land holding of 1 hectare or greater at the interior. In the second revision of the rule, that rule, particular rule, got changed massively. It got changed from 50 hectares to 100 hectares of permitted activity. And so some of the changes that we brought up here are what happened between when it was first put out, commission process, and then what was reworded and was sent out to the public or out to the updated committee at the beginning of May or April, whenever we got it.
Yes,
so there were quite significant changes within the two blocks of rule.
Yes. Just to explain, the one, that version,
yeah,
which was notified,
yes,
is the one that we're dealing with.
Okay.
The one that was sent out in May,
yes,
is Mr. Barr's opinion as to how he thinks we should deal with it, having considered all the submissions. So,
right.
So this is the one we're dealing with.
Yes.
The May version has his idea,
yes,
which is in the same status as your ideas or all the other submissions' ideas.
Okay. Well, you probably didn't realise that quite so much.
No,
but
we understand
what we were dealing with
for
now.
Many people, it's not so obvious.
Yeah. And so we've gone through and pulled your report to fit into the button. So all these policy changes in here and the rule changes in here are directly from
right,
the balance report. So I think that's probably very important that you are aware of that. And one of the other things, again to do with rural buildings, is change the height from a building in 21.5.18.6, reduce the farm building down to height to 4 metres. It should be the same as any rural building, as a residential building, it should be 8 metres, and then the area from 300 metres squared to 500 metres squared, and it just sort of drops things down a bit, which if you're going to get hay in a hay barn, the tractor and a loader, the last thing you need to be is stuck with a 5 metre high roof, especially when your house is towards 8 metres. But there's a few things like that we certainly don't have to agree with. So then what about the rules for a non-conformal airport?
Yes,
okay. And I'd also like to delete before then the 21.5.18.7, which was also snuck into Mr. Barnes' rules from the first one. And we certainly don't need them in there. This is good, which is privacy, outlook and rural energy from adjoining properties. Landowners have enough rights as it is without that rule in there. All sorts of blackmailing going on with that one. And then I will just simply read to you what I've written about the former airport. This document is treating fixed wing and helicopter activity the same. Fixed wing aircraft need informal airports to take off and land, and helicopters don't. But when helicopters land at informal airports, they must abide by local circuit procedure. Fixed wing aircraft have been in the geographical part of this district since within 1950. The height of aircraft used in the opposite district for agriculture was through the 1960s to 1970s, when nearly every farm was adjoined to the new strip for top dressing. Several of these still exist today in the Waikato Basin, now known as Macaulay, Monk, Bun, Jackson, Lady Mile. And each lake station has its own airstrip, which are vital to their farming operation and transport means. While helicopter aviation has become a predominant use, fixed wing aviation is still an important means of transport to, from, and within this district. With the increase in home builds and sports aviation aircraft, fixed wing aviation is increasing worldwide. There is a clear need for more farm airstrip or informal airports in this district that can accommodate the facilities that go hand in hand with fixed wing aircraft, such as hangars, etc. It's officially the Queenstown Airport Corporation appears to have a policy of removing all general aviation from the airport. From the now homeless box to the Aero Club that her father was a founding member of, right through to private jets. General aviation isn't going away from this district, it is a historic and vital element to the future of tourism in this district. And to refer to this report, the legal submission to the Queenstown Airport Corporation Limited. This is a very long-winded report to say that the proposed district plan needs to zone airports from rural general to mixed-use airport zone, and that general aviation desperately needs a base. And while powers at the Queenstown Airport Corporation are trying to direct all general aviation from Queenstown to Wanaka, this is just simply not going to work. Informal airports need to be beside roads. They are transport hubs, just as bus stops and taxi stands. They have set directions for takeoff and landing due to the orientation of the runway and wind direction. Just like Queenstown and Wanaka, and the seemingly forgotten about QLDC Rangiroki Airport, these runway landing lanes need to be protected. These must be protected from other land use, not the other way around, as the rule states now. An interesting article by Emily Murphy on stuff.co.nz, 26th May 2016, reported on predictions of chance of a major earthquake in the occupied fault line by the University of Canterbury earthquake engineer and professor Brendan Bradley. His model predicts a 50% chance in the next 50 years of the Alpine fault line rupturing. When, and if, this happens, these informal airports will be very necessary means of transport and lifeline to this district. In fact, QLDC should be identifying these informal airports as part of the emergency management plan. I must have got the reference into that article then. Just for something different that I haven't written in here on informal airports. And in the rules, in 21.5.26.2, I've added the word training after rescue, because training should be committed activity. And I know the two gentlemen behind me are going to speak to you quite deep on this. I would also like to add in there that private flights should be added in this issue. And here I'm speaking personally for myself. I am a private pilot. I'm a very low hour private pilot per year. My husband was killed in an aircraft accident. I don't want to end up in that same situation, because that wouldn't be very particularly fair with my daughter. And if I thought that I could go out and do some circuits and get myself current back in an aircraft, because I might not be in my committed range when we run out of landings on that airstrip by that point in time, something happens. I don't think that would fit very well anyway. It's very important for me, from my personal perspective, that private goes into the committed in that role. In conclusion, it doesn't matter as individuals whether we love or hate the progress that is happening in this district. It has a momentum of its own and it always has. As a district, we're planning to cater for the projected, are we planning to cater for the projected increase in growth? Yes, we are, but nowhere near fast enough. From my memories as a young teenager when my father was on the council from 1970 to the last district plan review to now, the local governance of this area is always playing catch up. We need to plan a stretch of 30 to 50 years out. So let's plan for all the unseen amazing things that will happen in this district in the future. Fix in a few large green areas left now for future residential housing development, rural essential, rural lifestyle, visitor accommodation, recreation, big box retail, commercial, light industrial, airfields, transport hubs, and anything else that the vibrant community will need in this district in the next 50 to 100 years. Then you will see a whole lot of stuff over here. So there's a rural residential and rural lifestyle chapter 22, and then this is again from report. that you would like, rules that you would like to just see altered and changed a little bit. To us, there's a couple of rules in there, some policies in there that are a little bit needed, and we think perhaps they should be changed to be positive. We've also put on an appendix of the evidence that we support. Appendix 3 is my email to the panel last week, about the evidence that you asked something in Brisbane to provide you on the number of councils, rural residential councils around the district. And it was completely wrong. All the things that would give you is an indication of where the residential areas are, but as far as how many houses it actually showed as being lived in or not lived in, it was very, very incorrect. So I can give my own take on that, which you will find in our submission with Barnes and Corporate Trustee. When we looked at the dwelling capacity model when we were doing our commercial take, we found that the planner had said that there were still 500 sections for rural residential in this district, and we were trying to figure out where, because on our town park there certainly wasn't. We eventually found out that the bulk of those sections were totally above code, and we also eventually found out that the planner, at that point in time, had simply taken the area of the rural residential area and divided it by 4,000 square metres and said that was how many rural residential houses should be allowed in the rural residential areas of the block of basin. Given that the minimum allotment size of 4,000 square metres for a rural residential section, that was always going to produce a number that was far too high. And a closer way of doing it would have been dividing it by 8,000 square metres. And for example, on all riding, because it's property, all riding in the rural residential area is actually attached to farmland estate, and only sections are within 8,000 square metres. That's all I needed to speak to you about today.
Just in terms of the your comments about informal imports and the need for keep your hours off basically, are those airstrips that are used for fixed winters, are they commonly used by people for their keep their hours on?
Yes, some of them are, yes. Most Jules and Carlton will probably speak to you a whole lot better about this, but the airstrips that are here are all privately owned, so basically they have one, maybe two people operating on them, but they're all operated by people who privately owned. The person who lives in Germany has an aircraft and that person's life. It just happens that both Roger and I fly, and Roger does both flying and I don't. So when I get back in the airplane, I need to make sure I'm current before I go anywhere or take passengers.
I understand that. Now this morning we heard from Real Journeys, and they have lodged a submission seeking a reverse sensitivity provision near informal airports, particularly related to airstrips, and their concern is with their own airstrip at Bulk Peak. But what I am interested in, and what they were seeking, was that there be within 500 metres of the strip, if anyone wanted to do a subdivision, there'd be some way of that being described as discretionary or controlled in some way that so that the effects on the airstrip could be taken into account.
Absolutely.
And is that something that you think?
Yes, and I've actually put that in here. I can't remember where I put it, but I thought that the rule should be the other way around, which is basically saying exactly that.
Yes. And then the next question that I had for them, and that you may be able to help me with, you note here that the instrument we know of in the basin was established in the 70s, and so probably or the 50s,
yes.
Before there were any district plans,
yes,
or district schemes.
Yes.
How would the council know about them?
They wouldn't. I mean, we'd have to be out there
and
tell
about
them.
That's what worries me with the rule. Is there a way that the council could identify them within the plan so that the general public knew that if they bought the section next door, they might have a restriction on how close they could be from the airstrip?
Well, I think that would be relatively easy to do, and we've got Jill behind him especially that would be able to do that in about very quickly, and I've identified six that I may have missed one or two that are still operating at the airstrip. I did that because you asked Stephen that question last week, and I thought that I should put those in there just so that there was actually some named airstrips in there. Depending on the town, I know where they are. Possibly the council doesn't know where they are, because as far as the Spitzland pilot, we've certainly never ever had an issue, so it would never have come up in front of anything in order to be a problem.
But
it's different to the commissioned helicopter activity.
But as you know, the basin is getting rather more populated.
It is, absolutely. And the pressure is going to come on to all these informal airports. And as you say, the people that come in there, so gosh, we didn't know that was there. And we probably have them, we've got new neighbours and they won't know that they're there.
Can we take over the top of their house?
Yeah.
I'll be tired, but then the reality is when every time you go and talk to the neighbours,
oh, yes.
Yeah.
But
they absolutely love it. Mm-hmm. They don't have planes taking off all the time, they have planes to
stop off. Do they, just the somebody who controls when you can and can't fly, do they have maps that show where these things are that you need for navigation and that kind of thing?
Yes, so under the. Correct me if I need to as well. So under a private airstrip, the landowner is completely responsible for who lands and operates on his or her airstrip. And if I was to go and land at, say, Walter Peak on Real Journey, I would need to ring you and ask if I was able to do that. And you have to have permission to be able to land at someone else's private airstrip.
Sorry. Are there maps showing where these airstrips are?
No.
Not the private.
Not the private.
No.
I'm thinking about how they might be incorporated, so I'm assuming that if they were identified, they would then potentially be shown on a planning map so that everybody was aware this is might say private airstrip, and then that's the thing that signals to everybody that that's how it works. Is
that would be a marvellous idea. It's something that should have been happening a while ago.
So we must have suggested to Mr. Barr, because he had a talk to you. You would
and maybe and the gentleman behind you quite probably as well.
Yeah, and then between the community of
yes.
Private aviators, they'd be able to provide the council with all that information.
Yes.
But how we dealt with it would be a different story, but that might be useful for us if he was provided with that, then we could see where the strips are. But that would help us in making a decision how to deal with them too.
Quite certain, in fact.
It's something that the council should have if they said if there was an earthquake and took out the main runway at the airport. Those informed strips could become a vital link.
As Commissioner Sinclair, quite quickly would be handy by the end of this week, if possible.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
This is a mission that I put together on behalf of a private flyers group to District Pan. This mission is a collective overview from a large number of individuals who fly aircraft and wish to continue landing in rural areas within the QLDC boundaries and several local district landowners. The relevant sections in the proposed plan, I think you can take those to the red, can you?
Thank you.
My name is Robert Jules Tapper. I hold a professional pilot's license and this November 2016 will be flying for 55 years. I have owned and operated various aircraft, helicopters and gliders for 52 years and have considerable operational experience within the current QLDC area. I first landed at the Queenstown Airport 53 years ago when the airfield was just a square grass paddock with several landing vehicles. I have thus had the benefit of observing aircraft using aeronautical development in the area over a considerable period of time. With my commercial aviation background in the area and involved with the Mount Cook Group and Air New Zealand Limited on previous airport planning matters, my personal aviation experience, I wish to make the following comments relative to the informal aircraft operations in the general zone. I would also just like to interrupt this narrative and just say my experience was 28 years in the Hollywood Valley. I was the founder of the Hollywood Valley Wharf, which is now owned by Nashville Tourism. And then I was 5 years in corporate life and was a semi-executive with the Mount Cook Group and involved in charge of all their South Island assets. That's a little bit of background where I've come from. First point I want to make, the new district plan contains some very impractical and onerous additions to what is already in the present district plan, what has been permitted in the past. For rural areas, the prohibition of any landing and takeoff on place or airstrip within 500 metres of the boundary road or residence shows complete lack of knowledge by the planners of what has been going on in the area for several decades. A lot of the airstrips are lighting places and aircraft hangars in the district are in many places located within the new parameters. And to suddenly impose its newest restrictions on pilots, aircraft owners and landowners are unduly restrictive, unnecessary, and places excessive conditions on landowners, especially on those who have for many decades operated aircraft in the area with no adverse effects to others, been on either itinerant flights throughout the district or to and from permanent base. Just an aside, I'd just like to say that when I listen to some of the submissions both online through my computer, listening to what other people said earlier to you folks, the analogy I'm listening to is that we appear as fixed-wing private operators to be charged with the sin of the father. Basically, the problem we've got in this area and what the planners are obviously trying to do is reduce the amount of condensed helicopter noise. And I know from a personal point of view where the problems are, as do you and the council, and especially those people living out near Nugget Point and out towards the kind of peak area, where there's been a real problem with heavy-duty helicopter noise, and especially with one company. So I just would like to make the point that those people have got a problem with helicopters. We're talking about itinerant operations for fixed-wing aircraft, and I can say that in my own personal experience, I've been landing at a spot for 40 years at Lake Hayes and never had a single complaint. And the big thing is, we're always being cognizant. When I had the Hollywood operation, we were garaging up to 3 aircraft on Mrs. Strange's property there, and we never had a single complaint because we realised there was other people that didn't appreciate aircraft noise, so we would take off and bugger off. And when we came back, we shut down quickly. We had good neighbourly relations right from the word go, and I was very cognizant. I think that most private owners, with the itinerant use that they do, are very cognizant of this point. In fact, I know a lot of helicopter operators who have a helicopter who are very cognizant of blade slap. When you're coming down to land, if you have too low a speed and too high a rate of descent, and your blade angle's wrong, you get this that tremendous wok, wok, wok that somebody may have heard, especially noticeable on things like that. We're employed helicopter. Very annoying to somebody on the ground that's done for a prolonged period of time. Can be totally eliminated just by flying techniques. So getting back to my point two, we attach a copy, which you guys would have attached to my submission, because it's a report the QLDC compiled by noted expert Dr. Stephen Charles. And then we refers to the Southern Planning Group produces the new proposed different plan change. His advice has either been totally ignored or rapidly changed to the proposal. You'll see on page four that Charles comments that if there were one movement a day of a fixed wing aircraft, the noise limits would be achieved with a 100-metre setback, not the 500-metre setback, and three movements per week now proposed by the Southern Planning Group. For helicopters, the graph on page 2 shows that for one landing and takeoff per day, the noise is satisfactory with a 200-metre setback, about 120 metres for one landing or takeoff. And at 500 metres, it's okay for 20 movements a day. Charles opines also in the NZ6805 and 6807, standards, and respectively, the 55 LDN and 50 LDN criteria may not be appropriate controls for low movement numbers, especially on informal airports. He also comments on page 4 that a limit of 3 flights per day on a 500 metre buffer is relatively conservative, quite. So the proposed planner's proposal of 3 flights per week appears a ridiculously conservative suggestion. Why planners have disregarded Charles' suggestion and based an arbitrary cap on movements of 3 per week is a mystery. As several farmers slash business people within the district use their aircraft more frequently as part of their everyday activities. No explanation as to the cap is noted, and we would submit that for aircraft owners with an existing hangar or permanent tie-down facilities were able to submit past usage higher than that proposed, if movements are to be restricted, an alternative suggestion of up to 3 movements per day is more appropriate for acceptance as a permitted activity. In remote areas such as in our background, for example up at the top of the Skippers, no movement restriction for private officers deemed to be more appropriate. 3. Owners and pilots are cognizant of the fact that aircraft noise is not appreciated by some members of the public, but to the best of our knowledge, no one is to blame to conduct circuit training from, in other words, going round and round doing takeoffs and landings from airships within the district, which fall within the new 500 metre restrictions. Thus, continuous noise from the activity is not a problem. Pilots take off and depart the area, observe the landing conditions, and then land. The aircraft noise footprint for others on the ground is of very short duration. In most circumstances, it would appear that this new boundary in usage restrictions by parents smacks of toffee syndrome and letting the fun police loose, rather than for practical reasons. Now, these are opinions expressed by people other than myself to me, so I've just passed them on. 4. There are many owners and private operators who, without any problems or complaints, have been flying to and from rural areas for several decades. The QLDC has been aware of this activity, and along with part of the public, have accepted it as part of the area's transport and infrastructure. Under Section 10 of the RNA, it also appears that existing use rights would apply to their operations, and they should be permitted to continue, provided there's no further increase in scale or intensity. For all the above reasons, and in order to recognise existing use, we would propose that any new plan conditions only apply to any new place being proposed for the purpose of aircraft landing and take-off and landing, and also that the restrictions on movement of 3 to week per week be replaced with 21 in any calendar week, a maximum of 3 per day, or unlimited in backcountry remote areas, such as up at the top of the Skippers, and the setback on new alighting areas being 100 metres for fixed wing and 120 metres for rotary wing aircraft. This submission is made on behalf of the private flyers group and several rural landowners. I wish to be able to speak to you and welcome any questions from the media. And I'm a little bit deaf, so if you can speak up, please.
Thank you.
Well, I've been talking loudly, that's what I can hear myself.
Is an alighting area takeoff managed for an alighting area?
Yeah, the lighting area. Yeah, the lighting area is just a pad that quite often people will be landing in. It may not be a designated airstrip, But generally speaking, in the basin here, where we're getting more and more intensification, the ESIS, there will be no more ESIS in this area, I'm sure of that, because first of all, the land, the paddocks are getting smaller, and you're getting so close to houses, there's no way that as a new airstrip, the QLDC would allow. What we're saying is for the existing airstrips that are here and are very intimately used, they should be able to remain. We're not asking for anything more. We just let's look after what we've got. There are, of course, other airstrips other than in the space. For example, the drone, as you drive by the ski field, you'll notice that strip. There's all sorts of strips around the area, but I'm just very concerned about a viewpoint that seems to be taken relative to what's happening in the basin, which has been caused by intensive helicopter operations, commercial helicopter operations. And it's going to affect, if this goes through, this would affect a lot of private operators who are very intimate. And just one thing I just mentioned that one of the commissioners, you did say, sir, basically about putting airstrips on a map. One of the things that you would do if you put it on an official aeronautical map showing things, you would actually invite people to uninvite land on strips. And that's not what we're all trying to achieve. What Debbie said before was correct, that if you're going to a chap's place, you usually, I've never landed on a person's place without asking. Could I land there? I always have permission for this. And sometimes, of course, if the landing stop movements or something like that, they say, no, it's not convenient for months. That's fine.
Yeah. What the solution that I was trying to see that could come up with was something where there's a way of identifying it on the plan so that other people know that these things are here relative to the issues that Mr. McColl raised before.
So you're trying to keep it. I think really what you made a suggestion to the planning here that you get together with Debbie and myself and maybe Calvin, and we identify the strips that we know of which are used relatively regularly. Most of them go back to the old top dressing days or the old top dressing down here. And we identify those in the plan. The people there are then able to continue using the aircraft or have people alighting there on possibly a restricted basis, but I think it's too restrictive. You know, generally speaking, I look back through my records over the last 20 years and there was never more than one landing or takeoff in a day, because generally what's happening, we're coming in from the coast, we're coming home, we're coming for a resupply, we do one landing and one takeoff, or we come home at night and put the plane away. And so we weren't operating the area, so it's very short duration also.
Just in terms of when it says on the plan, it says one movement, three movements, whatever.
Yes.
Is one movement either just coming into land or just taking off, or is a movement
a movement is considered a landing and a takeoff.
A landing and a takeoff. Okay.
Yes. For charging purposes, the airports tend to use movements as a landing only, but they charge the landing charge. Yeah. But yeah, we talk about a movement being a landing and a takeoff.
And the, my only other related question is, if you were doing it, that the area that I understand that you're talking about, just the Wakatipi Basin.
Well, no, I specify that because I don't believe that there is a problem anywhere outside of you know, if somebody wants to land down a lot, and he's just the other side of the Devil's Staircase, there's a strip you've probably never seen in your life, it's up on a terrace, it's a top dressing strip. They might get four or five people landing there in a year, other top pressing aircraft. There's no problem there. And I'm sure that we're all concerned about noise intensification. And you're dead right when you talk about reverse sensitivity. It is going to be a problem, and it's going to be a continuing problem as we see what's happened down at Henry Downs. But that reverse sensitivity that's coming in.
Would it be an issue in the upper Clutha, and so should what, if it works in terms of the flattening exercise works, what should have also been carried out in other parts of the district to provide certainty for the people that own those airstrips as well.
Well, I know what you're getting at. The thing is, it may not be a problem, but eventually it may become a problem. And so what you're saying is, if it works here, why shouldn't we put it elsewhere in the district? That's it. Yeah. I see no problem with that at all. Yeah. But there are quite a few. Take the chap up at the Brunswick Station. He's got an aircraft that's the only way he can reach to get in and out in the winter. And he uses it a lot for private use. And I'm just saying to him, he should have no restriction on how many land he can take off. There's no one else up there. It's all his land. And so we don't have a, we haven't got a noise or a nuisance problem. So that's the thing that I'm trying to differentiate between, say in the basin here, where we've got a lot of people, and the odd landing and takeoff that we do. But there are houses, and you've got to try and fly good neighbourly, as they say.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Tappy. You've sort of suggested an exemption for the backcountry areas where there's no how would we practically put a ring around the areas where there is a nuisance effect and those areas where they're not? Is it as simple as the Rockaboo Basin sort of built up area versus everywhere else?
Yes, well, this is a problem for you, but I think you've got to say in rural general land where there isn't intensive housing or there aren't a lot of houses, these things won't apply. So in other words, if you were, say, up at Paradise, up there, what have you got? You've got the Thompsons and the Nets and one or two others, very few, and maybe there's no need for that. But the chances of them wanting to do, remember we're talking about private ops, you could actually put this in the plan, private ops. So say Jeff Thompson, who's playing, wanted, if he was restricted, well he shouldn't be restricted, but that strips me there for years, and that's what I say here. Say it was a news strip and he was aboard an airplane, and you said to him, well, three landings and takeoffs, but I think it would probably suit him, except that they were in top risk, of course, and that's an exempt operation. Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Taylor.
Thank you. Appreciate the
opportunity to speak. And please note that, as stated in my written submission, while I work for the Civil Aviation Authority of New Zealand, I speak today as an individual, a pilot instructor, a flight examiner, an aircraft owner, and a GLBC ratepayer. My name is Carlton Campbell, and I've been flying for 46 years, both privately and professionally. While I've flown in several countries, my predominant experience has been based out of Queenstown, training and examining pilots, particularly for the local scenic and charter operators. As a consequence, I have extensive experience operating on the rural airstrips at West and Chapter 21 that was planned. I commend the planner's response to submissions where the 500 metre distance from roads and the number of movements have been amended. However, I don't believe this has gone far enough, given many existing airstrips are closer than 500 metres to houses, zones, etc. And two landings per day does not exist with pilot competency and therefore safety. Aviation is as essential to our society as any other form of transport, and any interference with it must be viewed in the wider life cycle context. Fixed-wing activity particularly so, given that operations are limited to a long enough piece of land, typically an aerodrome or airstrip, free of obstacles on both the departure and arrival fans, and aligned as much as possible into the prevailing wind. Such places are integral to the transport system, as are boat ramps, jetties, harbours, bus stops, taxi stands, railway stations and helipads. It is easy to acknowledge the importance of an airstrip for the purpose of top dressing activity and other agricultural objectives such as pest control. However, it is also important to realise that for some remote landholders, access for various reasons, whether emergency or normal, is critical. Recreational activity can also rely on aviation as much, sometimes more than other forms of transport. Often neglected in occasions such as this district planning process is the fact that pilots don't just appear qualified out of the blue with the skills, competence and currency to operate on airstrips. The training required is extensive and ongoing. It requires, among other things, training experience in various seasonal, weather, loading and different aircraft types to be safe. As with any airline operating into Queenstown Aerodrome, the strip training commences with initial training on any particular strip, transition training to experience the wide range of differences in weather, service conditions, seasonal variances and more sophisticated aircraft, and recurrent training, as Debbie was referring to earlier, to accommodate lack of currency due to illness, leave or other miscellaneous reasons. These are legal requirements of operating in professional activity and moral if operating privately. Such airstrips are essential to local commercial operators' safety plans in event of any emergency, and continued competence for their pilots is integral to that safety plan. Natural disasters can often mean airstrips play a significant part in rescue and recovery processes. Therefore, availability and access to such airstrips is essential to safety and the life cycle of aviation at all levels. Currently, a significant proportion of the airline pilots operating into Queenstown experience their early training and employment in what is called general aviation in this area. When considering implementation of any plan changes as it pertains to aviation activity, I believe consideration must be given to separating out both the private and commercial and the aeroplane and helicopter activity. Helicopters have infinitely greater flexibility for landing areas and use much less real estate. Fixed wing aircraft, however, have much more limitation on the landing areas available. The likelihood of new airstrips being developed in the region, let alone the country, is very limited. If this plan defines that numbers of landings must be determined, then it is necessary to understand why and how such numbers would be policed, and by whom. In most circumstances, the weather has a culling effect on the numbers, simply because approximately a third of the time weather itself prevents the activity taking place. Private activity is not a user of intrusive intensity, except when a rare group fly-in may occur, or training is being conducted, and even then it is seldom intrusive as instructors are conscious of flying neighbourly principles. When training is conducted, having a restrictive number such as 2 movements per day is not conducive to safety, as competence would very rarely be achieved in 2 movements, given approaches from both directions and different configurations would generally be necessary. A consenting process for private operations is unnecessarily cumbersome and impractical, given that applying for consent for a particular occasion on a particular date cannot and does not allow for the vagrancies of weather and its impact on planned activity. A recreational pilot sees that today is a nice day for a fly and goes flying, just as a picnicker or surfer goes to the beach on a suitable day. An instructor needing a crosswind for training purposes cannot plan for that day in advance. Commercial activity, by comparison, could in most cases be self-policing, as operators have significantly more document control requirements that are regulated than do recreational pilots. Throughout my tenure as the Chief Flying Instructor of the Wapitipu Aeroplane, and as a flight examiner conducting the operational competency checks for most of the Queenstown operators, It would not have been in the interest of safety to have pilots know the planned simulated emergencies requiring the use of an airstrip in advance, such as a consent process might require, as that would not have been realistic and their response to such simulations would not be a real insight into their competence. Also, during this period, I had extensive involvement in the council planners' considerations of rural airstrip activity management. Successive planners became aware that particularly for airstrip activity, the consent process was onerously expensive for all parties and that existing use rights was the relevant principle. I therefore recommend that recreational and training use of existing airstrips remains a grandfathered existing use right with no limits on the number of landings conducted, and that where commercial activity sought to use an existing airstrip, that activity be a consent process where landing numbers were realistically determined for viable economic activity, respectful of a bankable total, in acknowledgement that daily figures are not realistic given uncontrollable weather factors. And I'm sorry, as I walked here, I thought of one other point that is probably relevant. My mother lives in a different town to Queenstown, and the town made a diversion as to where the heavy truck and bus traffic would go, which ended up being straight along her street. 24 hours a day, rattling empty trucks as they go past, is something that we have limited controls over. The road traffic has to go on the road, and we have limited influence, shall we say, on the noise of that activity. Aircraft have to go onto an airstrip or a piece of real estate suitable for the activity, and yet we seem to have a lot of focus on the noise that generates, and doesn't seem to me to have a balance between those two forms of transport by any stretch of the imagination. But thank you for listening to my submission.
Sorry, I do. When you were training people for landing and taking off, and you were saying two movements isn't enough given the different approaches you need, how many do you need?
That is very much a factor of the individual pilot concerned, because if their experience is limited or their experience on strip activity is limited, and also the conditions here vary significantly. You can only take, for example, up at the Greenstone in winter time, the horse or cow droppings suddenly are like rocks because they freeze solid. And so the variables that you have are very much dependent on the individual pilot's experience and their ability to reach a level of competence before you can leave them independently able to operate on the strip. And each strip itself varies depending upon the threats, if we can use that term, that exist at that particular strip.
When you're talking about the strips that you would land on and have this, doing the simulated emergency landing thing, are you talking about the same strips as Mr. Tapper was before?
Yes.
You might, I think you'd have to ring up with the instructor and get permission from that person beforehand to use it as an emergency strip.
When I was working here, we had a relationship with all the landowners in terms of the use and the a number of landings that we would do. Typically, we did our utmost in any one exercise to limit it to no more than three approaches from each end. But that might necessarily not mean that the person was competent and you'd have to return on a number of occasions.
So just in relation to that, in terms of training, if you were a young pilot and you were just building up your confidence, would you be likely to, for example, contact a landowner in a different part of the district that had specific conditions around the airstrip and request to go and use that for a certain period of time for a training exercise?
You're talking about potentially two different groups of people. Those that have access to their own aircraft can land wherever they obtain permission to land, and there's no supervising individual over those persons. However, they do need to achieve a level of competence in terms of being able to do that. Those who are under training in a formal training organisation such as an aeroclub or a flying school are under the supervision of that operation, and those individuals would need more than just the landowner's permission. They would need their instructor or their chief flying instructor's approval for it, because they might not yet be at a level of competence. Just because you've got a pilot license or you can land and take off doesn't mean to say you can operate anywhere, in the sense that different aerodromes, Milford is a classic example where there are a whole lot of threats there that an uninformed pilot might not be aware of without training.
Thank you. I think that we've got a really good steer from the three submitters on that. The only question in terms of our request for identifying existing airstrips, I wonder if your boredom of it, would you be able to assist with those outside of the Moffatipi Basin?
Certainly, in terms of if there were a group of us here who had that experience, you'd probably manage to get the list very, very close to 100% correct.
That would be very helpful for us. And if just using the planning maps, just a little circle or something to show where they are, we don't need to see the takeoff fans or landing fans, it's just to know roughly where they are for the system. Thank you.
No problem.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you. For the June 12th, please.